A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 12, Being Good and Being Secular, Can an Atheist Be Ethical? The Ethics of Jean-Paul Sartre.
This lecture is called Being Good and Being Secular. It's about the atheistic ethics of Sartre. Kant didn't think you could prove the existence of God, freedom, or immortality by theoretical reason, but he thought he could prove that it was necessary to believe in them by practical reason. He thought these three ideas were necessary presuppositions for any adequate morality. I suspect he was wrong about immortality being necessary, because not only can you believe in morality without believing in immortality, but Kant himself says it's a purer motive for morality if you do the right thing just because it's right, rather than because it's going to be rewarded in this life or the next. Kant gets his morality of pure motive in place first, and only afterwards asks about these three implicit presuppositions or postulates for morality: God, freedom, and immortality. Plato, in the Republic, deliberately kept immortality out of his argument for justice over injustice until the argument was all over, and he brought it in only in a kind of appendix in the last book of the Republic. He did this so that he could prove that justice was its own reward, that justice was virtuous and wise and profitable both for itself and for the happiness, the health of soul that it brought in this life, whether or not there was a next one. And then he proved that there was a next one. And in the Bible, God seemed to use the same strategy. He did not clearly reveal life after death to his chosen people until many centuries after Moses, probably to avoid it being a bribe and to elicit a purer motive for being good in this life than being rewarded in the next. Be ye holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. That was to be the sufficient reason for morality. Only later did the life-after-death rewards get revealed once that pure motive was in place. But what about the other two ideas? Freedom and God. Jean-Paul Sartre, perhaps the most sheerly intellectual atheistic writer in history, centered his ethics around two ideas: the reality of freedom and the unreality of God. But he had a radically new concept of freedom. Not the freedom to choose to obey or disobey a moral law, but freedom absolutely, freedom from all law and constraint and limitation, freedom to make law, to create values. And he uses this notion of freedom and the notion of atheism to prove each other. There can't be a God because otherwise I would not be totally free, and I am totally free because there is no God. To understand Sartre's notion of freedom, and to put it into the great conversation to relate him to the history of Western philosophy, we have to clearly distinguish two different kinds of freedom. There are many kinds of freedom, depending on what they're freedom from. There's the freedom that is the opposite of slavery, and the freedom that is the opposite of political tyranny, and the freedom that is the opposite of imprisonment, and the freedom that is the opposite of addiction, whether to drugs or to certain pathological states or feelings or sin. But the two kinds of freedom we have to define and distinguish in order to understand Sartre and place him into the context of the great conversation are freedom of will, or free will on the one hand, which is a traditional idea, and what we might call metaphysical freedom on the other hand, which is a very radical, new, untraditional idea. And that's the kind Sartre teaches. First, let's look at free will. The history of Western philosophy shows us three options: to assume it, to deny it, or to prove it. Most ancient philosophers, like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, assume it without labeling it or defining it. For instance, Aristotle distinguished in his ethics actions that were voluntary and thus subject to ethical criteria and actions that were involuntary. Second, you could deny it. This was done by a minority of ancient philosophers, mainly the materialists, Leucippus and Democritus and Lucretius. They taught that everything real, even man and mind and choice, are made of matter, made of atoms. These materialist philosophers denied free will and said everything happens by necessity. The entire universe, including man, was for them an extremely complex machine. A few Christian theologians also deny free will because they believe in divine predestination. Calvin is the most famous. Luther also denied free will, wrote a book about it, but he probably meant by free will only the ability to save ourselves from sin by our own power, or the freedom to do good without God's grace, which is another issue than the power of moral choice between good and evil or between two goods. The third option is to affirm free will, to define it, and to defend it. That's the mainstream Christian view. Aquinas gives us this very simple argument for it, that moral language becomes meaningless if it does not exist. That is a practical argument. Our moral practice of praising and blaming and rewarding and punishing and counseling and commanding show that we do in fact believe in free will, and perhaps that we have to believe in free will. Around 1900, the American philosopher William James, the founder of pragmatism, gave this practical argument a new twist. He was a rather skeptical philosopher. He didn't think we could prove very much at all by theoretical reason, and he divided philosophical beliefs into what he called live options and dead options. Live options were beliefs that made a difference to your life, and God, free will, and immortality were three obvious examples of live options for him. James criticized most philosophers for thinking about dead options most of the time, issues that made no practical difference, no difference in your practice, in your life. Well, James was an agnostic about God and free will and life after death. He found good reasons for both free will and determinism, the belief that all our choices are totally determined, necessitated, caused by forces in our heredity and our environment beyond our control. So he expressed his indecision in a clever parable about a philosopher in Boston, where there were many philosophical clubs 100 years ago on a certain street. The philosopher didn't know whether to believe in free will or not, so he didn't know whether to join the Free Willers Association on one side of the street or the Determinists Club on the other side. He decided to join the Determinists Club, so he knocked on the door for admission. The doorman said, "Why have you come here?" He replied, "I came of my own free will." So the doorman, of course, slammed the door in his face. So he went across the street to the Free Willers Association. He knocked on the door. The doorman asked him the same question, "Why have you come here?" He replied, "They kicked me out across the street, so I had no choice." So that door was also slammed in his face, and he found himself out in the street. But James gave this practical, pragmatic reason for believing in free will. He says, "The issue is whether I have free will or not, and we don't know whether the answer is yes or no, so our ignorance leaves us free to choose to believe in either answer." So he says, let us choose to believe in free will, because that will make the best difference in our lives. It will give us a sense of dignity and importance. We're not just helpless cogs in a machine. And it will make morality meaningful. It will make us personally responsible for our choices. We can't pass the buck and say, something made me do it, as Adam and Eve tried to do when they ate the forbidden fruit. So, James says, we can freely create the free choice to believe in free will. Now, some philosophers affirmed free will and some denied it, but none affirmed the kind of freedom Sartre affirmed, which I've called metaphysical freedom. That's the freedom inherent in our radically unique mode of being, which Sartre calls being for itself, as opposed to being in itself. These are his two main categories. Being for itself, or human reality, he also calls existence, as opposed to essence. Now, when you hear these terms, please don't despair. I'll define them when I have to, and I'll translate Sartre's very abstract and technical language into ordinary common sense language. Freedom is certainly Sartre's favorite idea. And his new notion of freedom, which is going to have radical ethical consequences, comes directly from his metaphysics. Once again, ethics flows from metaphysics. And the key idea in his metaphysics is what he calls the distinction between being in itself and being for itself. This is essentially the difference between objects, being in itself, and subjects, being for itself. The distinction between objects of consciousness and subjects of consciousness, or things and ideas on the one hand and persons on the other hand. Things have essences and natures that we can express in concepts and definitions. According to Sartre, persons do not. Man has no essence. There is no such thing as human nature or the human essence. This follows from atheism. Sartre says there is no human nature because there is no God to conceive it. So man is totally free of boundaries, definitions, limits. He can make himself whatever he wills to make himself. He creates his own essence, his own meaning, his own values. So ethics is totally free and totally arbitrary. Nothing justifies one set of values rather than another, or one act rather than another. Sartre uses the formula, existence precedes essence, as the origin of the term existentialism. Sartre invented that term. Not all philosophers who are classified as existentialists agree with Sartre, by the way. By essence, Sartre means definable nature, something that's confined within limits, like a triangle confined within three sides, or an acorn confined within the species of oak, or Lassie, who can only be a dog, whose meaning is set for it by its natural species. That's the traditional notion of essence. But Sartre has a new, very non-traditional notion of existence. By existence, Sartre means only human existence, not the existence of a thing like a rock. We humans have a unique way of existing, says Sartre. We are subjects and not objects. We are being for itself, that is, conscious and free. And therefore, we are not objects of consciousness or of free choice. He gives the example of a paper cutter, a machine designed by man. It has an essence because man conceived it and designed it. And it has a purpose, an end, a value as part of its essence because man made it for that purpose, to cut paper. Now, Sartre says, theists believe that man is like a paper cutter because he is conceived and invented by God, designed and planned and created by God. So the idea of man in the mind of God corresponds to the idea of the paper cutter in the mind of man. Man has an essence, human nature, and a meaning and a value because he is an object of divine knowledge and will. But if you drop God, see what follows. There is no human nature because there is no God to conceive it. And there are no values for man, no meaning and purpose to human life because there is no God to will it. That's what Sartre means when he says existence precedes essence, that there is no pre-existing essence or nature or meaning or concept or design or definition for man at all, as there is for things like paper cutters and even things in nature like rocks and acorns and cats, which have a species, a nature, an essence, even though we didn't design them, and neither did God, according to Sartre. They just evolved by chance. But they have a limited, definable, preset nature and limits. Their lives, their careers in time are all predictable. It follows a script. But we are not in any play with a pre-written script. We just turn up on the stage, and we have to write the script as we go along. Human life is all ad lib, all improvisation, including ethics. There are no preset moral laws or rights and wrongs or natural rights or objective values. Ethics is pure art, not science. Invention, not discovery. Subjective, not objective. We are free from essence. We create our own essence. Our existence, our life, precedes our essence. That is the freedom inherent in our very mode of being, what I've called metaphysical freedom, our mode of existence as subjects and not objects. So, Sartre argues that this philosophy is the only one that gives man dignity, that does not reduce him to an object, a kind of paper cutter in the mind of God. Traditional Jewish and Christian and Muslim philosophers would argue against this, that man is an object designed by God and therefore has an essence, but they'd say that he also is a subject because he is created in God's image with free will as a subject of moral choice, a subject of knowing and willing, that man has freedom and dignity precisely because of God. But Sartre arrives at the conclusion that man is free from the opposite starting point, that there is no God. But the freedom he means is not just free will, not just freedom from determination or predestination, whether by God or heredity and environment, but freedom from meaning, freedom from having an essence, freedom from having a human nature. What we are, our nature, our character, and our goals, and our purposes, and our values, and our ethics, all this is totally up to us. Our being, what we are, is not given to us, either by God or by nature. It is made by our own choices. Sartre says that receiving anything is incompatible with being free, whether that anything is your nature, your values, a gift, or even love, which Sartre denies is possible. The consequence is that for Sartre there is no such thing as the meaning of life. Life is not designed by an intelligent author, and therefore full of meaning and significance. It signifies nothing. Life is strictly meaningless. Absurd is his word for it. For nothing can justify any of the meanings that we give to it. There are no eternal objective truths to judge our changeable subjective truths, since there's no divine mind for them to be in. And there are no objective values to judge our choices, since there is no divine will for them to come from. He writes, "My entire philosophy is an attempt to draw all the consequences of a consistent atheistic position." That's one good reason to study Sartre, whether you are an atheist or not, as an exercise in seeing the logical consequences of an idea. Ideas have consequences, both in theory and in practice. Another reason to study Sartre, if you do not agree with him, is to appreciate the alternative by contrast. We usually appreciate a thing most only when it's taken away. We appreciate comfort through discomfort, health through illness, riches through poverty, and life through death. When someone dies, we almost always regret not appreciating him enough when he was alive. So with God and an objective meaning to life, which Sartre deliberately yokes together as part of a single package deal. A third reason to study Sartre is that he constitutes a test for the relation between ethics and religion. Can there be an atheistic ethics? Is ethics dependent on religion? There are four possible answers. Sartre and Euthyphro both say yes, ethics is dependent on religion. Remember Euthyphro in that Socratic dialogue. And Sartre says no to any objective ethics because he says no to religion. That's the first possibility. While Euthyphro says yes to ethics only because he says yes to religion. That's the second possibility. A third possibility is that if Socrates and Aquinas, who say yes to religion and to ethics, but who don't base their ethics only on religion and faith, but also on reason and philosophy. And a fourth possible position would be that of Plato, who seems to have had no real religion yet has an absolute ethics. So if you are an atheist, the issue would be Plato versus Sartre. And if you are a theist, the issue is Socrates versus Euthyphro. There's a fourth reason to study Sartre, and that is his existential challenge, his challenge to your own personal life and existence. Sartre's most powerful writings are not his philosophy, I think, but his fiction, especially the novel Nausea and the play No Exit. Nausea shows us Sartre's immediate and direct experience of life as meaningless, absurd, and nauseating, before all the arguments and technical philosophical concepts. And it's very powerful and terrifying. And to those who would point to this nausea and terror as a reason for not studying Sartre, I would reply with Socrates' famous statement that the unexamined life is not worth living. Socrates would say that it is better to honestly face the question of whether life has any meaning or not, even at the risk of giving the negative answer to that question, than to cover it up and refuse to ask the question, because that's not completely honest, and honesty is an absolute value. It is better to face the question of the meaning of life in nausea than never to face it at all. In this novel, Nausea, the protagonist, Roquentin, who is obviously a projection of Sartre himself, looks for meaning in his life everywhere, rather like Solomon in Ecclesiastes, and concludes, like Solomon, that life is vanity of vanities, meaningless. He makes five experiments with meaning, tests five candidates for the position of the meaning and purpose of life, the summum bonum, and they all fail. First, as a historian, he seeks meaning in finding truth, historical truth. But he becomes convinced that there is no objective truth in history. It all comes from the historian, not from the world. It's all subjective. Then he tries to live a life of wild adventure and concludes that there are no adventures, just things that happen, one after the other. That's all. There's no meaning to any of them, no reason to risk your life, no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Third, having given up on God, he tries to find meaning in humanism, worshiping man as God. but he finds that he can't idealize man. He finds that man is so disgusting and dishonest that he can't be a worship object, only a worship subject. But there's nothing higher than man to worship. Fourth, he looks for human love, for someone to affirm him and make his life meaningful. But all he finds is women who need him to make their lives meaningful. Two zeros don't make one positive integer, much less two. Finally, he contemplates suicide, to do away with at least one of these zeros, these meaningless existence. But he realizes that even this would be meaningless, that it's no gain, that neither life nor death are at all meaningful, and that his meaningless corpse is no more meaningful than his meaningless live body. The one most promising experiment of the five is love. Sartre admits that if genuine love were possible, love of the other for the other's sake, then that would make life meaningful. But he denies that it is possible. He has never experienced it, either by receiving it or by giving it. His autobiography, The Words, is very candid and revealing there, by the way. And so is Paul Johnson's one-chapter summary of Sartre's life in Intellectuals, a very illuminating book of mini-biographies of modern intellectuals. In his play No Exit, Sartre has three people finding themselves dead and in hell, but there are no demons or fires to torture them, just each other, to torture each other forever. Obviously, Sartre doesn't believe in life after death or hell, but it's a parable of this life. Each of the three needs and craves love, but each one is unlovable and dishonest, and the only way each can love is not to look, to live a lie, to pretend not to know the unlovable characters of the other. But the pretense is impossible. Garcin knows Estelle and therefore does not love her. Estelle knows Inez and therefore does not love her. Inez knows Garcin and therefore does not love him. Sartre is saying that the two things everyone needs absolutely are to be known and to be loved. Truth and goodness, light and fire, two things that distinguish us from the beasts, the two powers of the soul or the spirit, and the two knowable attributes of God in Western theology, and the two things that 20 million Americans who have had out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences always say they receive from the being of light if they met him: total, true, complete, non-illusory knowledge, and total, complete, non-judgmental love. But this is impossible together, says Sartre. This love is impossible for the same reason God is impossible. It would be the synthesis of being in itself and being for itself. Being in itself, the being of objects or concepts or impersonal forces, is perfect and knowable. But it's not a person. It's not free. It's not capable of loving you or knowing you, only of being loved and being known. And being for itself, human reality, is always on the way to becoming itself. That's why he calls it being for itself. It's always imperfect. It's always making new choices in time to try to create its essence, but it can never get there. We are always imperfect and therefore always unlovable. So the things that can love, persons, are not lovable, and the things that are perfect and perfectly lovable, ideals, concepts, essences, objects, these cannot love. Another way to put Sartre's argument here is that genuine altruistic love would have to proceed not from need and imperfection, that would be selfish, egotistic love, a love that I need as my body needs food, but it would proceed from perfection. But perfection is found only in objects and concepts. Objects can't love, and subjects, persons, are imperfect and needy and selfish. So the only two kinds of love Sartre recognizes are some form of sadism or masochism. In sadism, you are the subject, and you reduce the other person to an object. You take away their freedom. In masochism, you let the other person do that to you. All attempts at love come to this, says Sartre, I-it relationships, never I-thou relationships. There's a dull little word that all lovers find suddenly lights up with magic when they fall in love. It's the word we. That word is strictly meaningless to Sartre. There can be no we subject, only an I. And there can be only one I, as there can be only one God. I can't recognize you as another I. another subject, another person. And therefore I can't recognize you and me together. So the argument against love is the same metaphysical argument as the argument against God. Both would be the impossible synthesis of being in itself and being for itself, object and subject, beloved and lover. God would also be both perfect and person, which is impossible. Another way to put this same abstract argument, if any one of these ways makes sense to you, use it and don't worry about the other ones. Another way to say it is that God would be both I, or being for itself, a person, a subject that can know and love, and also being, a perfect being, or object, or essence, or being in itself. That's exactly the two things God said he was when he revealed his name to Moses, I am. He's both I and am, both person and being. Sartre sets up his two metaphysical categories to make God impossible. So what are the ethical consequences of Sartre's atheism? First, of course, that goodness is subjective, man-made, arbitrary, non-justifiable, and utterly different from one individual to the next. There are no universal moral principles, and therefore we can never be certain whether any choice is good or evil. Sartre tells the story of the soldier fighting the Nazis in the French Resistance movement who came to him for advice. His company needed him, but so did his mother at home, who was dying, and he couldn't be in both places at the same time. Sartre says there was no possible advice he could give this young man. Each of the two goods excluded the other. The right thing to do in concrete choices like this, says Sartre, is not universal, not definable by any universal rules, but totally up to the individual. A second consequence is that we can never choose evil, since we create the meaning and value of our choices by our act of choosing them. What I may do could be evil to you, but it's always good to me. That's why I did it. There is no pre-existing moral law or moral meaning that can judge anyone's choice as really evil. Sartre tries to mitigate this individualism by adding something like the Kantian categorical imperative in its first version. He says that in choosing what I choose for all mankind. But he gives no logical basis for that I can see. It's just that if he didn't include some minimal moral principle, he would have no morality at all. A third consequence is that ethics is as creative as art. We're not only free to choose our actions with free will, but also free to create whatever value we choose to create. A fourth consequence is that there's no such thing as progress, because progress means betterment, and that means getting better, getting closer to a real good, a goal. But there is no real goal. To judge that something progresses is to presuppose that it's getting closer to a real goal, and that goal must be stable and unchanging, otherwise there can't be any progress towards it. Imagine a base runner trying to steal second base. He couldn't make any progress if the second baseman grabs the base and runs with it towards third base as fast as the runner is running from first to second. Many people who call themselves progressives say that they do not believe in any static, changeless, eternal truths or goods or principles or ideals. Sartre sees the logical self-contradiction there. If there are no changeless truths and goods and goals, then the very idea of progress makes no sense. And if there is no God, there is nothing eternal. Sartre writes, there are no eternal truths because there is no eternal divine mind to think them. Here Sartre offends many of his fellow atheists who call themselves humanists. The term humanism sometimes means simply a philosophy that affirms the intrinsic value of a human being, whether for religious reasons or not. Or it could mean a deliberately anti-religious philosophy which says that man should not bow to any superior being, that there is no God superior to man, that man is in the highest place. This is often called secular humanism. Sartre says to his fellow secular humanists that he does not agree with the strategy of the most famous and influential secular humanists, the philosophers of the French Revolution and the so-called Enlightenment, who wanted to do away with God as an unscientific and harmful idea, but wanted to retain the notion of absolute values, eternal values, unchangeable moral principles. Sartre says that makes no sense for metaphysical reasons. If there is no God, There are profound consequences that follow for morality. Sartre writes, "The humanist wants to get rid of God with the least possible expense. Something like this. God is a useless and costly hypothesis, and we are discarding it. But in order for values to be taken seriously, there must be some a priori goods. It must be good a priori to be honest, to speak the truth, not to beat your wife, to have children, etc." Sartre replies, "Not so, because we are in a reality in which there are only men." He writes, "The existentialist, on the contrary, finds it very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding meaning and value in some heaven of ideas disappears along with God. There can be no a priori good because there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it." An a priori good would be something that is good prior to our experience, prior to our knowledge of it, or our willing it. In other words, objective values. Dostoevsky had prophesied this. He had his atheistic character, Ivan Karamazov, reason, "If God does not exist, everything is permissible." Ivan very much wants God not to exist because he wants everything to be permissible, because he hates his loathsome father and wants to murder him without guilt. Sartre writes, "God does not exist, and as a result, everything is permissible. And as a result of this, man is in despair, because neither within him nor without does he find anything to cling to, anything to give him meaning." You might think that atheism is an easy philosophy because there's no cosmic father wagging his finger saying no to anything you may want to do. But I think Sartre sees deeper than this. His next sentence is not, "and as a result, man is free and greatly relieved of his old burden of guilt," but rather, "and as a result, man is in despair." He sees, just as Viktor Frankl sees in Man's Search for Meaning, that our deepest need is not so much freedom as meaning. And he thinks those two are incompatible. Either we have total freedom, because there is no God, and therefore no real objective meaning, and no preset values to limit our freedom to create whatever values we will, or else we have only limited freedom, but an objective meaning, because there is a God or something like a God. If not the God of Abraham, at least the God of Plato, the eternal idea of the good, or the God of Aristotle, the uncaused cause of all change in the universe, a perfect being, or the God of Kant, the ideal that we should believe in even though we can't prove that he exists, in order to justify the absolute morality of the categorical imperative, or even Hinduism's Brahman, or even Buddha's Nirvana, or Confucius's will of heaven, or Taoism's Tao, some eternal truth that we can fail to conform to and thus be wrong. In Sartre's world, no one can ever be wrong, because everything is permissible. And everything is permissible because there is no God. And because there is no wrong, there is no real right either. And as a result, we are in despair, meaningless and absurd. Sartre is an example of what William James called a tough-minded philosopher. He affirms his final conclusion that we are absurd simply because he thinks it is true, not because it makes him happy. James classifies all thinkers as tough-minded or tender-minded, and he says the two can never agree because they have two different non-negotiable absolutes. The tender-minded says that goodness or morality or happiness is the absolute, and the tough-minded says that objective truth, facts, is the absolute. Well, one could be tender-minded or tough-minded, and one could be an atheist or a theist, and that would give us four possible combinations. Sartre is a tough-minded atheist. He is an atheist because he thinks it's true, not because atheism helps him to be good or to find meaning or to overcome despair or to be happy. The humanists that Sartre criticizes are tender-minded atheists. They are atheists because they think atheism is useful, fashionable, a way to overcome myth or guilt or old-fashioned ideas, or they're atheists because it makes them liberated. Another very famous tender-minded atheist is Nietzsche. If you know anything about Nietzsche, you may be surprised that I call him tender-minded, but his argument for atheism is as far from tough-mindedness as you could imagine. He is an atheist not because of objective facts, but because of his subjective feelings and desires. I will quote Nietzsche's argument for atheism. He says, "I will now disprove the existence of all gods. If there were gods, how could I bear not to be a god? Consequently, there are no gods." Nietzsche wills God out of existence. He kills God. He announces not that God does not exist, objectively, but that God is dead, and we have killed him. A third possibility would be a tough-minded theist like Aquinas, who believes in God because he thinks he can prove that God does in fact exist. For a tough-minded thinker, the only justification for believing any idea is that it's true, whether it's desirable or not, helpful or not. C.S. Lewis is a good example of a 20th-century tough-minded theist. He says in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that he was converted from atheism to theism as reluctantly as possible, kicking and screaming, the most reluctant convert in all England. The fourth possibility would be a tender-minded theist who believes in God not because he's convinced it is true, but because that belief is helpful, useful, comforting, or necessary for morality. That's Kant's position. Morality is Kant's absolute, and he thinks that if there is no God, there cannot be real absolute morality. But he also thinks there is no way of knowing whether there is or is not a God, because metaphysics is impossible. So we must live as if there is a God, even though perhaps there is not. Just to challenge you, let me give you my personal opinion here. I have more sympathy for Sartre than for Kant on this issue, because even though I believe that God really exists, I also believe that honesty is an absolutely absolute absolute. And living as if God existed, even if perhaps he doesn't, sounds subtly dishonest to me, like believing in Santa Claus, even though you're old enough to know better, but it makes you feel good and behave better around Christmas time. If I were God and had to judge Sartre and Kant, I would give Kant the severer purgatory because he didn't learn lesson one, the primacy of truth, while Sartre did. Or seemed to, anyway. Only God knows. Next time, we will look at the relation between ethics and Eastern religions rather than Western, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism.
After listening to Lecture 12, a student posed this question to Professor Kraft. Why did Sartre write books if he considered everything to be meaningless? Let's listen to the professor's response.
If Sartre were asked the question, if everything is meaningless, why do you write books? He wouldn't try to give a meaning for it. He would, I think, say, writing books is simply an activity. It's like blowing up a bubble. There's no substance inside or outside of a bubble. There's just emptiness and meaninglessness. But a bubble is the place where the inside emptiness expands, if the bubble expands, and the outside emptiness contracts. So the only thing to do is blow up your bubble. It's like Nietzsche's will to power, but without the passion. Writing is simply a meaningless activity like breathing, but it's what I do, says Sartre, so I do it. But you don't have to have a motivation for doing anything you do, according to Sartre. Actually, if you want to read a more poetic and passionate atheist, I'd recommend Nietzsche. Beyond Good and Evil, his attack on religion and morality, is Sartre plus poetry and passion.
This ends Lecture 12.